What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you. We have a great show for you today, and I want to thank everyone who's already here. And of course, I want to urge people to give this stream a thumbs up, give it a like. Also, please subscribe to the stream if you haven't already. We have such exciting news. I want to thank everyone for subscribing because as of last week, we hit 100,000 subscribers. So very excited about that. We have, as usual, a great show for you today. And I love when we get to have two great guests talking about two really fascinating things. And that's what we're doing today. We're going to have Arnaud Bertrand talking to us about China, about the new Cold War, about Sinophobia or Sinophobia, depending on how you pronounce it. And also the parallels between Sinophobic imagery and anti-Semitic imagery. And then we're going to be talking to Lev Galinkin about the media's whitewashing of Ukrainians Azov Battalion. Of course, feel free to support the show, again, just with a thumbs up and or by subscribing, but you can also become Patreon supporters. We are releasing shortly that great live event that I did with Breonna Joy Gray. The quality was so good that we were delayed a little bit because of editing, tech issues, which Brad can explain later on in the show if needed, but that is on its way. You'll be able to access that at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And in order to see this night's full stream, if you're watching live, you'll see the whole thing. If you are watching this later, to see the full stream, go to patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Also, if you can support the show at the $5 level, that's how you get these great extra interviews, extended interviews, bonus content. If you can't afford that, you can still support the show at the $1 a month level. So that's like $12 a year. And we can't make the show without you guys. We really can't. So please do consider becoming Patreons at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. So we're just going to bring on our first guest. And we're so excited. He's making his Katie Helper Show debut. Arnaud Bertrand is an entrepreneur and a social activist. He founded House Trip in 2008, which grew to become one of Europe's foremost tech startups and which he sold to TripAdvisor in 2016. He's now working on his second venture, Me and Qi, or Me and Qi, I'll have to ask him how to pronounce that, I realize, which helps people understand how traditional Chinese medicine can benefit them. Arnaud is a frequent commentator on China, advocating for a better understanding of the country and its people, as well as more friendly relationships between the West and China. So Arnaud, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Thank you so much for coming. First thing, how do I pronounce it?
Qi. It's qi. It's like the energy in Chinese medicine.
Qi and mei. Okay, got it. So first of all, how did you become interested in China? And tell us about where you live and where you're actually joining us from.
So I became interested in China, like all good stories started with a love story. So I met my current wife, the woman who became my wife in 2006. We were studying together in Switzerland. And I remember the exact moment, actually, when I started rooting for China. Basically, it was we were in Switzerland watching the Olympic ceremony, you know, when it was in Beijing in 2008. And my wife started crying during that ceremony. And she's not an emotional person at all. And at that moment, I realized the depth of the feelings that Chinese people have for China, the so-called humiliation that they felt during, you know, the 150, 200 years when China was colonized and so on. It's not just a political slogan. It's something that's deeply felt by the Chinese people. And that struck me. And since then, I've been advocating for, you know, helping China develop and grow back to being, you know, a country like all the others.
Can you set the scene for us about what is happening now between the West and China?
Sure. So, I mean, like everyone knows, China has developed economically quite substantially. By some measure, its economy is even bigger than the U.S. right now. If you look at GDP, PPP, as you call it, and I guess that has implication for the world order, because you know, so far the US had a kind of a hegemonic position in the world order, and with China becoming so powerful, that basically questions that, especially in Asia, and I guess that the US takes offense with that, and is trying to roll back and contain China so that it can maintain its position of superiority, at least in the Asia-Pacific region.
And what do you think of the West's attitude towards China, especially with the Biden administration?
I think the Biden administration is probably one of the worst ever when it comes to its relationship with China. And they're very hypocritical about it. So they keep, I guess, you know, let me give you one example. For instance, this recent semiconductors export controls, where they put together a very aggressive measure to basically try to forbid China to import any of the more advanced type of semiconductors. And, you know, all the experts who look at that say that that's a move to slow down or even arrest China's development, because so much in the world right now, so much of the technological progress is based on semiconductors. You know, just 2 days ago, you had Blinken in China saying that basically that has nothing to do with to slow down Chinese development. It's basically, you know, the way he presented it, it's almost a normal friendly measure when it's it's a lot of this, you know, doing extremely aggressive move also on Taiwan and so on, that they're simply not honest about that. They don't admit that that their policy is a policy of containment, trying to start a new Cold War, trying to divide the world into blocks, when that's really what it is.
Right. So Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, he said, "One of the important things for me to do on this trip was to disabuse our Chinese hosts of the notion that we are seeking to economically contain them. We're not. We are not about decoupling. We're about de-risking and diversifying.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm speaking about. Yeah. So it's a lot of words, but then the deeds are in complete contradictions with the words. So the Chinese are actually quite insulted by that. It's one thing to do aggressive measure. It's adding insult to injury when on top of that, you don't admit your measures are aggressive.
And what is it you think that the Biden administration wants vis-a-vis China?
I think it simply wants to conserve its position in the world. It wants to conserve the American-led world order, as simple as that. And to be frank, I do understand the U.S. position. So much relies on that supremacy. If you look at the dollar, for instance, the only reason why the dollar is the global reserve currency and that the U.S. has this what the French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing used to call the exorbitant privilege is because they have that that position. And if they lose that position of supremacy, then that will have a negative consequence for the U.S. So in a way, the U.S. is also a prisoner of its hegemony. They've put themselves in a situation where if they lose the hegemony, then it will have quite negative consequences for them. But that's not fair to those other countries who say we want a more democratic world order where, you know, different civilizations, different models can coexist. We all have a similar voice. We're all worthy of respect. We are equals. There is no nation above another. So that's the dynamic.
I wanted to also play a clip that has been getting a lot of attention. People are seeing this as some kind of declaration that Blinken made. Let's play this clip of Blinken.
Taiwan, I reiterated the longstanding U.S. One China policy. That policy has not changed. It's guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, 3 joint communiques, the 6 assurances. We do not support Taiwan independence. We remain opposed to any unilateral changes to the status quo by either side. We continue to expect the peaceful resolution of cross-strait differences.
So you have all these people commenting that China is, like, the U.S. is doing China's bidding, bought and paid for by China. He just embarrassed himself. He just submitted to China. What are your thoughts on not only that statement, but the reaction to it?
I mean, actually, the truth is the exact contrary. So when he says that our one China policy has not changed, it's factually changed because one of the core tenets of the one China policy was the so-called strategic ambiguity, where the U.S. had as a principle not to say if they would or not defend Taiwan in case of war. And as we all know, Biden by now has 4 times said that the U.S. will defend Taiwan. Also, you know, historically, all American troops had been withdrawn from Taiwan when China and the U.S. established diplomatic relations at the end of the 70s. Now, very recently, I think 1 or 2 years ago, U.S. troops are back on Taiwan. The U.S. sent 200 military trainers. So from China's standpoint, the way they read that comment by Blinken is just sheer hypocrisy. It's quite funny that people then on the U.S. side, I mean, some people, I guess, on the right in the U.S., I'm not sure who exactly is commenting that, said that's the U.S. submitting to China because it's completely the opposite. And as per not supporting Taiwan independence, which is, I think, the part of the statement that makes them react the most, that also has been one of the core tenets of U.S. policy for decades. And so it's no change at all. But again, it's only words. When you look at the facts, actually, just by removing strategic ambiguity, that is supporting Taiwan independence, because Taiwan independentists, separatists, what they're much more encouraged to declare independence from China if they know that, you know, whatever they do, the U.S. has their back and you have the most powerful military in the world that's going to protect them, than if the U.S. says, it depends, our protection depends on the situation. So in fact, they are moving towards more support, at least tacit, for Taiwanese independence.
You actually tweeted a bunch of images demonstrating the similarities between xenophobia and anti-Semitism. And we actually have some of those images. I was wondering if we could show them and you could kind of talk us through some of your findings. Was this one of the images?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a common theme in both xenophobia and anti-Semitism, dehumanization, comparing people to insects on the theme of the infiltration, like their influence is everywhere, they've infiltrated us, that's very telling. It's the big aggressive Chinese dragon strangling the world, and we use to depict Jewish people as well like that. The goal of world domination is also a common theme.
Right. So we have two images here. We have like a claw, right? We have it's from the Financial Times, an assertive China challenge, and has a dragon hand. Right. And then on the right side, this is some kind of anti-Semitic cartoon. And we see someone representing, I guess, Jews, who also has wings and claws and a tail and is also around the globe.
Yeah.
That's pretty scary.
Or the squid that has its tentacles around the world. So I think that there are a lot of quite striking similarities, not only in the iconography. That's to cover all covers of the famous anti-Semitic book, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and Military Review, which is, a U.S. Army official journal, almost took the same iconography to illustrate a special edition of on China.
So they have the serpent in both of those.
Yeah, there are strikingly a lot of very common themes between xenophobia and anti-Semitism. So yeah, infiltration, duality also, that's a big one. Recently we had the head of the French Foreign Intelligence Services saying, and I quote, that every Chinese citizen is regarded by the Chinese as an activable intelligence agent, which, of course, is also a common anti-Semitic trope, with Jews being seen as morals to Israel than their own country, when the truth is that the Chinese, all the Jews, of course, are human beings with free will, and they aren't more activable than anyone. Goal of world domination, the whole blaming COVID on the Chinese, which we actually had the same thing during the bubonic plague in Europe, when it was blamed on the Jews. Then we have the whole blood libel thing, so which was a common theme in anti-Semitism. The Jews were accused of stealing Christian blood, stealing Christian children, and taking their blood, or other atrocities. As everyone knows, we have a lot of atrocity propaganda on China, which is extraordinarily effective. You depict the people as committing atrocities to rile everyone up against them and then justify clamping down on them. For the Chinese, we have, organ harvesting, running slave labor, genociding the Uyghurs or the Tibetans. I even saw a story by Reuters that was about the Chinese killing babies to make edible powder with their flesh. Like, you have stuff like that. That's crazy.
You also saw, what was it, Adbusters? I just saw Adbusters. I shouldn't even say this because I saw you retweeted this.
Yeah, they compared Xi to Hitler, right?
Yeah, they compared Xi to Hitler. What is that?
Yeah, that's...
I mean, I'm sorry, that's not really a question. It's a bit of a leading question, but I'm looking for their tweet, which was pretty embarrassing. And this is Adbusters. These are people who used to do... Margaret Kimberly had a great tweet about them that I'm looking for right now. Okay, I found it. Brad, I'm going to send you a link, okay? So can you zoom in on that? So this is from Adbusters, and they used to do like what culture jamming. I don't even know how to describe what they did, but they used to think that they were into Occupy Wall Street. And they tweeted, years before Chamberlain caved to the Nazis, we knew where Hitler was going, knew the stakes, but we kept putting up with him because we wanted to do business with him. We just didn't have the guts to take him on until it was too late. The same thing is happening with Xi. And then they have in this weird font, I'm not sure what they're trying to suggest, the next Hitler, question mark. So, Margaret Kimberly, who's, I always love her takes, she tweeted that out and said, I used to have respect for this organization, but now they are comparing President Xi, who is bringing peace to much of the world, to Hitler. So what's your response to that? Xi, he's just like Hitler comparison.
Yeah, I mean, the comparison is insane. It's completely historical. When you look at what China has done over the past four decades, not only they've not started any war, they haven't even fired a single bullet abroad in 40 years. So to make the claim that they're an aggressive power, Hitler-like, is absolutely demented. Or if you look at what they've done internally, they've listed hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, the biggest improvement of living standards in the entire world history. It's literally absolutely nothing to do. And they're communists. They're not extreme right.
They were on the other side, in case they missed that. Yeah. It's very weird because, Adbusters, they define themselves, just going back to the organization that tweeted this, they define themselves as a global network of activists, writers, artists, designers, tricksters, poets, philosophers, and punks. Our aim, win the planetary endgame. And they published an article about Xi. In fact, I'm gonna just share this article because I think it's kind of an interesting case study. Let's see. We've been here before. Let's see what they wrote. Okay, hold on a second. All right. We've been here before. Years before Chamberlain caved into the Nazis, we knew where Hitler was going, aware of what was at stake, felt what was coming, yet we kept putting up with his ever-escalating swipes. I mean, is that like an understatement or what? Swipes? This isn't like Tinder. Okay. Indignities and arrogances. We just didn't have the guts to take him on until it was too late. Now the very same thing is happening with Xi Jinping's China. We're appeasing him, tolerating his mounting pugnaciousness, compromising our values for economic favors, blindly following the same script that got us into World War II. Be warned, nothing short of an all-out meme war can avert World War III. If we can't heal our divisions, rally around our democratic values, if we can't come up with a better story to believe in than never-ending growth and consumers' distractions, if we can't look Xi Jinping in the eye and ask why he is keeping vital information hidden from his people, why he is committing genocide in... Wait, how do I pronounce that?
Xinjiang.
I can never pronounce that correctly. Why he is building artificial islands in the South China Sea and why he is slapping punitive sanctions on every nation that dares to challenge his predominance. If we can't meet might with ideological might, then halfway through the 21st century or much sooner, we'll wake up one fine morning, shake our heads and wonder why we're now vassals in a China-dominated slave state more horrifying than anything Orwell ever dreamed of.
Yeah, I mean...
Is this a joke?
You have actually, there are several of the themes that we're speaking about during the conversation on the comparison between anti-Semitism and xenophobia. And the big theme in that article is world domination. But the idea that China will want to dominate the whole world and enslave us all, which is absolutely ridiculous. It's totally contrary to Chinese culture. If you look in, they have like 5,000 years of history, so we know a thing or two about China. And what they've always done historically is actually build walls, the Great Wall of China, the Great Firewall of China, the sanitary world during COVID to protect themselves and isolate themselves from the rest of the world. They've never gone abroad. They've never gone to other countries around the world trying to colonize them and so on. In their religion, you've never had missionaries, Chinese missionaries going outside China trying to convert people to Taoism or other Chinese religions. It's totally not in the Chinese culture. And most serious observers agree on this. Like Kissinger, for instance, in his book on China, he said, China never espoused the American notion of universalism to spread its values around the world. It's just not at all what China is about. They're about trying to pursue multipolarity and get legitimacy in the eyes of the world for their own system, but not impose it on other countries.
It's really crazy. And these are people who have like some progressive stuff in their timeline about like Palestine, but they're
very confused.
They're very confused. And we're here to help. That's really an insane thing. I mean, while I was reading, I'm like, am I going to get in trouble? Is this an actual parody? But it's not. Because they're in the timeline calling people, tankies who are criticizing them. So you also had, very interestingly enough, you debated Adrian Zenz. There was a Harvard-hosted debate, and the debate was whether or not the Chinese system of government is better than the American system. We're going to get into the substance of that debate. But first, can you tell us about who Adrian Zenz is?
Sure. So Adrian Zenz is a German researcher with quotes around researcher. He works for the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation.
The Victims of, what is it? The Victims of Communism?
The Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation.
Memorial Foundation, which is something Bill Clinton started?
Yes, I mean, it was set up by Congress as basically an anti-communist propaganda shop. That's informs a lot of his research and his takes. And him personally and his organization are really at the origin of the Uyghur genocide claims on the data around it, if it could be called that. I guess he's quite famous in China circles for his data. I think the Grayson did actually a pretty good article on this, on specifically one of his most important claims, which is one of the key data to justify the existence of genocide, which is that 80% in 2018, 80% of all net added IUD intrauterine devices placements in China were performed in Xinjiang. It's been that specific number has been repeated by a number of government officials, newspaper, and so on. Understood as 80% of all IUDs that were placed in China that year were placed on women in Xinjiang. That's crazy. That proves that they're trying to stop Uyghurs from having children. But actually, that's an accounting trick. That's not what net added IUD means. When you calculate the actual number based on the same raw data that Adrian Zenz uses, you find that the number of IUDs placed on women in China that were placed on women in Xinjiang that year was only 8%. So literally an order of magnitude less. So he plays around with the data like that to push his narrative, inventing new numbers like net added IUD that they're actually meaningless, but make it sound like there is something very, very troubling going on. And that's a big part of his shtick.
He also has some religious orientation, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he's a fairly religious man.
He's a born again.
I'm not quite sure, but
yeah, he is. Yeah, he says that.
Okay.
I think he feels like it's. He has said something about doing like something about God. He actually like gets into. He says he's like led by. He feels led by God. And he has a book about rapture, the rapture. So And let's get into the substance of that debate. Can you talk about what you argued in this debate? Which is interesting. I watched the debate. I recommend it. Yeah.
Sure. So it was a debate on basically which system is the better system, the Chinese or the American, on delivering liberty, prosperity, and stability for their people. And there was a vote at the end, and quite incredibly, I won the debate, which is a tall order, winning a debate at Harvard University, arguing that the Chinese system is better at delivering liberty. but I guess my argument on this was that in the West we've come to have a very somewhat skewed understanding of liberty, where we view it as only individual liberty, when there is actually a broader understanding of liberty. So for instance, one key initiative that the Chinese government has made is their anti-poverty drive, which is very enough. I've traveled all over China. Literally, the whole population is extirpated from extreme poverty. And I argued in the debate that that's actually an important measure of liberty. Who can argue that poor people are free? When you're poor, you're literally a slave to your condition, right? On China, you can look at the data as the more than any other countries, especially the US or France, to extirpate people out of poverty. Or there is also freedom from fear. China is a very safe country. As a woman, you can walk anywhere in China in the middle of the night wearing a miniskirt. You will never be annoyed, whereas that's not exactly the case in most Western cities. So there are a number of measures of liberty that where actually China fares a lot better than the West. But I guess my biggest point also in the debate is, it comes back to what we were saying earlier, it doesn't quite make sense to compare both systems, because one system, the American system, is universalist. So basically, let's say we are a system for the whole world. We want to convert, we think our system is the best possible system, and we think all countries should adopt it, whereas the Chinese system specifically says, no, our system is very much adapted to our own history, our own context, geopolitical context, economic context, and so on and so forth. And it wouldn't make any sense for any other country to adopt our system. So the comparison doesn't quite make sense, because there is literally no chance that any other country will adopt the Chinese system, because it's so uniquely Chinese.
And what else do you think that people need to know about China, given how much Sinophobia there is and ignorance about China exists?
I mean, there are so many things. So China is, I've traveled in 53 countries in my life. And China is the only country that's really, really, truly, completely different from any other country. Because it's grown so independently from the rest of the world, as per its culture. Even if you look at the language, most countries in the world share a common root in the language, so Indo-European languages. Even India has the same root, but the Chinese language is completely separate. The culture, there was no influence from. There is a very interesting sentence in a book from Blaise Pascal, who was a famous French philosopher in the 17th century in France. And I think the sentence went something like, who is more right, Moses or China? And that resets the scene, those are the two key systems, basically. There is Moses and everything that stemmed from that, like all the Abrahamic religions that form the basis of our civilization, and, you know, Muslim civilizations and so on and so forth, and China, which is totally different. So I think people try to understand China too much from a Western mindset, but they don't comprehend the depth of the difference in the way of thinking on everything, even things that are so basic, like the difference between good and bad, for instance. In Chinese culture, that's not the way that they see it. It's yin and yang, where things are not good or bad. The goal is to reach a balance, a harmony between things, where there is a bit of yin in the yang, a bit of yang in the yin, and you try to achieve harmony and balance instead of striving towards extreme good and seeing everything that's not good as bad. So if I had something to say about China, that would be it. Try to, you know, be humble in the fact that there is so much you don't understand. I'm really trying to understand China takes years to a Westerner, because you need to relearn everything about what you've been told, the most basic assumption, the way your brain is wired since your childhood, because it is such a different culture.
I also wanted to know what you say to people who, I hear this quite frequently, people are like, well, China wants to dominate the world. If we're up to them, we'd all be living under their system. You hear this from people who are not idiotic. I mean, maybe definitionally you could say they're idiotic because they think that, but it shocks me how much people who fancy themselves as smart will say stuff like that.
Yes, and I think maybe also part of the blame can be put on the Chinese for that, because if there is one thing that the Chinese, contrary to many assumptions, many claims of malign Chinese influence and so on, the Chinese are actually terribly bad at propaganda, explaining what they're about. It's really shocking how bad they are about telling the China story to the world. You actually have, you're only ever exposed to one side of the conversation. The Chinese side of the conversation is literally inaudible to the world, because they tell it in such a way that no one listens to them, basically. So when you only have one side of the conversation, it's very, very hard for people, even well-meaning people, to understand China, because they only have that, they only are exposed to that. On really understanding the Chinese side, actually it takes going to China, spending years there to try to comprehend the culture, mingling with Chinese people and so on. No one does that. I mean, very few people have the time to do that. So yeah, I think that's the key issue.
And anything else that you want to share with us? Anything that you think that people should know?
I mean, there are many things that people should know about China. I guess my big message would be, be humble. Don't believe everything you read from the, at face value. Try to take a step back, maybe try to read Chinese sources, try to understand that, you know, simply the Chinese people are human beings, like everyone else. They deserve development. They actually like their government. Try to be a bit more humble. I guess that's the big message.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining, and would love to have you back on. Give us more updates.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, everyone, if you haven't already, please do give a thumbs up, because this is a great chat. We want to make sure people can hear it and see it. Also, make sure that you, if you're not already a Patreon subscriber, please become Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/theKatieHalper Show. By the way, I meant to say this when Arnaud was still on, but Adrian Zenz wrote the book, Worthy to Escape, Why All Believers Will Not Be Raptured Before the Tribulation, which is about, there's some view of the rapture, which I think is weird, a weird thing to do. Like, I mean, everyone can believe in what they want, but I just think it's a weird area of scholarship for people to be doing. I mean, theology is fine and religion is fine. I just think I'm not going to get my social science analysis from someone who focuses on the rapture. That's what I'll say. But he's the source for many people, which is interesting and problematic. So we are going to bring on our next guest. And as Brad says, please remember, hit the like button, share, and subscribe. And our next guest is coming back to the Katie Halper Show. We're so excited to have him back on. He's the author of a great book that I really recommend called A Backpack, A Bear, and 8 Crates of Vodka. He also writes for places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, CNN, the Boston Globe. He's appeared on MSNBC, NPR, ABC Radio. And he has yet another great article at The Nation. And that article says, before Russia invaded Ukraine, these fighters were neo-Nazis. They still are. It's called The Western Media is Whitewashing the Azov Battalion. Before Russia invaded Ukraine, these fighters were neo-Nazis. They still are. So, Lev, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Thank you so much for joining. Let's start off with you telling people about where you're from, so people have a sense of your perspective on this.
I'm originally from the city of Kharkiv, now called Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine. That's the giant industrial city, the second biggest city in Ukraine, that's very close to Russia. And it also happens to be a city that had a neo-Nazi street gang called Patriot of Ukraine. And that street gang eventually formed a battalion, a paramilitary called the Azov Battalion, which in turn grew and grew and grew over the next 7 years to become a brigade in the armed forces of Ukraine, in the military of Ukraine, in the National Guard. And I've reported on it for a long time, and I've noticed that as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, this was last February, so this is February 2022, shortly after the winter of 2022, Western media, which spent the past 7 years talking about how Azov is neo-Nazi and how Azov reaches out to white supremacists across the world, how it recruits them, how it's basically a hub of neo-Nazism, suddenly Western media just started reversing itself. And suddenly all of these groups started saying that this organization of battle-hardened neo-Nazis had suddenly and magically stopped being neo-Nazi.
They read White Fragility, I think. They did a sensitivity training, yeah.
Yes, we shipped crates and crates of White Fragility to Kyiv, and it worked. So this is all happening at the same time, and this is what makes it so psychotic. This is happening at the same time when people are saying about how white supremacy is this existential threat to America and to the world. So at the very same time as we're saying all of this, we're also saying, hey, this neo-Nazi paramilitary is suddenly not neo-Nazi anymore. And then, and this is by the time like September, October rolled around, we not only were whitewashing them, we went to celebrate them. So suddenly we started having these fascists in Congress, on MSNBC, in elite universities like Stanford. So in the space of just several months, we've gone from acknowledging they're neo-Nazis to saying anybody who says this is really a Russian puppet to saying, you know what, these people are actually heroes.
And we actually have some images that you sent over that we could show, I think would be interesting to look at.
Yeah.
And everyone, make sure you check out this article. Also, Lev had a great article we had him to talk on about that was at the New York Times, which is about Operation Paperclip and the kind of rehabilitation of lots of Nazis and war criminals who get things named after them, which is interesting. Okay, so, well, that's the article. So actually, before we show the images, can you tell us what this is?
Yeah, this is the piece that just came out in The Nation. I'm deeply grateful for them for allowing me to have this. It also came out in print. And it's this. It's my story about how this is the Azov group. And it's not just a battalion. They call it the Azov battalion, but by now it's a brigade. But this is the Azov group. This is its founder right there doing the salute. And Andriy Beletsky.
That's the one on the right side with the watch. The one whose watch we see, right? Watch band? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's he was the leader of the neo-Nazi gang in Kharkiv that founded Azov. And
what is that symbol?
That symbol is called the wolf's angle. It is a neo-Nazi symbol. It is the wolf's hook. It's several Third Reich divisions use that insignia. It is something that you popularly find on neo-Nazi websites. And this is something that Azov used and has continued using. This is a unit in the National Guard of Ukraine. So this is a unit in the military that we are funding. And this is that's using an outright neo-Nazi symbol.
Brad, can you go back to that article? Because there's another image in there that I wanted to ask about. And this?
Yeah, this is the Patriot of Ukraine. This is the neo-Nazi gang that formed Azov. As you can see, it clearly used the wolf's angle. They claim that it's actually a letter N and a letter I. But I mean, that's also like, you know, you could say that, oh, this is in the swastika. It's two letter Z's juxtaposed on it. It clearly is a wolf's angle. This is Andriy Beletsky. This is the same guy at the podium that you saw, just younger, back when he was just leading this party. And his dream was to have Ukraine lead the world in the struggle against the Jewish-led Untermenschen. And he's got his dream purring along because now he's been, you know, he's reached this. This would have been, he would have just been a local neo-Nazi gang leader. And Azov with the Patriot of Ukraine would have just been another gang. And instead, now they're getting celebrated in the highest quarters of power in Congress, in American media, everywhere. So this is a dream come true for them.
And this poster right here?
This is also just from an initial old poster from Patriot of Ukraine, back when they would do their little the Hitler Youth type marches. But again, this was back, there would have been nothing. There would have just been another neo-Nazi gang, which is certainly dangerous, but nothing approaching the level of international groups that are now armed by the United States and that are more than anything that are celebrated, which is also just a very, the message that this sends to neo-Nazis across the globe is, if you fight for us, we'll hook you up. We'll not only turn a blind eye, we'll celebrate you. We'll make you heroes. You know, and this is including, I want to say this, including also Facebook did this incredible, I mean, this is like, you know, the famous drill tweet where it's like, you know, you do not have to hand it to ISIS. Okay. It's Facebook had Azov listed as a hate group. Okay, it was, they banned their accounts across the board. They had all of their different organizations, the military wing, the street gang wing, everything was blocked on Facebook. Suddenly, last year, Facebook announces that it's going to Azov remains on its banned groups list, but it will now allow praise of Azov, provided that the praise is in the context of them fighting Russia. So these people, they acknowledge that Azov remains a hate group, but says that, you know what, there are times where they can be good guys. That's a message of this sense. The sense that there are valid reasons for praising neo-Nazis. That certainly there are bad reasons for praising neo-Nazis. That's why they remain on the hate group list. But there are certainly valid reasons. And eventually Facebook decided to just simplify matters and they just removed them from their... from the groups altogether. This is, like I said, this is Time Magazine from even the year before that, from 2021, I believe. Okay? This is the entire Western establishment understood that Azov was neo-Nazis because they just kept growing and growing. when I first started covering it, people called me and my late mentor, Stephen Cohen, they called, you know, they said they were Putin puppets for saying, but eventually Azov just got to the point where they just got big enough to where they couldn't be ignored. And then suddenly all of us, you know, they started fighting for us and the entire Western media just started whitewashing them, just based on nothing, just based on lies, like easily disprovable lies.
I heard you on a podcast I was listening to earlier today, and you talked about Michael McFaul, who is the former ambassador to Russia, and he kind of did one of these like not all Nazis kinds of statements.
Yeah, I mean, he said, you know, I'm concerned about Nazis. He said, I'm concerned about Nazis in Ukraine. I'm concerned about Nazis in Russia. I'm concerned about Nazis everywhere. You hear that often from Western spokesperson people. They'll say, you know, well, what about the Nazis in Russia? And Russia does use neo-Nazis. Russia has an entire organization based on that, okay? And my answer is, what about them? I mean, the difference between the Russian neo-Nazis and Azov is that the Russian neo-Nazis are not being armed by the United States. They're not being celebrated in Congress. They're not being invited on MSNBC. That's the difference. So the issue is the fact that Putin uses neo-Nazis. Of course he uses neo-Nazis. All that shows is that, A, it's a dangerous thing in Russia, okay, and that Putin is absolutely full of garbage when he says he's claiming to fight neo-Nazism. Yeah. The thing is, it's like anytime you're like, well, which neo-Nazis could we do something about? The ones that are fighting for Putin or the ones that we are arming and we are celebrating, we are whitewashing? You know, it's like not all, you know, all neo-Nazis matter. I mean, that's a pretty weird, that's a pretty weird thing to say when there's one group that you can do something about that you're directly enabling versus, oh, what about this other group?
Also, it seems like, I mean, one of the things that I believe your late mentor, Stephen Cohen, said was that in order for Zelensky to not be pushed around by neo-Nazis, who, again, their numbers, it's not a question of their numbers, it's a question of they have the guns and they have a lot of power in Ukraine, that there isn't, that is not the equivalent in Russia, because the relationship between Putin and his people is not the same thing as the relationship between Zelensky and his people. Putin and Nazis versus Zelensky and Nazis. I mean, you had that footage of some neo-Nazis basically threatening Zelensky. And so one of the things Stephen Cohen said is that if the United States wanted to fortify or strengthen Zelensky against neo-Nazis, they really would have had to have had his back in a way that they didn't.
Well, we always go, everywhere we go, we use radicals, whether it's in Syria, whether it's Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden. And it makes sense. I mean, these people they're highly organized and they're not afraid to die and they're not afraid to kill. So it's you know, unfortunately, the odds of us the odds of us doing something about them is, given our history, is rather small. We love groups like that and we use them all the time. You know, I can't help but get the feeling that if bin Laden in the 80s was today, media would be celebrating him. They actually did. I mean, The Guardian actually did a story about the warrior for, you know, fighting the Soviets. So he would be on Instagram. He would be, you know, we would be celebrating him just like we're celebrating Azov now.
We also have some more images that you had sent me that we could look at.
Please. Yeah. Okay. So this is to set the background. Okay.
Oh, can I ask you a question? Is this a fair statement? Scottish Lion writes, Russian neo-Nazis aren't integrated into the Russian army and they are banned in Russia. Most Russian neo-Nazis got angry at Putin because he banned them from participating in politics. Is that a fair assessment? What's your...
I would say no, because the Wagner Battalion, you can say it's not part of the Russian army, but it really is part of the Russian army. I mean, it's their... They're serving as a paramilitary, but that's directly part of the Russian army. Russia certainly uses plenty of neo-Nazis. There are neo-Nazis on both sides of the conflict. I mean, that's just unfortunately, that's the reality. And if we were arming the Russian neo-Nazis, then I would say that should be the number one priority also. Putin is, of course, disingenuous. Not to mention the fact that just because Ukraine has neo-Nazis doesn't give him a right to invade an inch of Ukrainian soil. But it's this duality of Azov and Putin really need each other. They are bound together, okay? Because Putin uses Azov to defend the indefensible. Putin uses Azov as an excuse to invade a sovereign nation. Azov and its defenders use Putin to also defend the indefensible, which is that we should be lionizing and arming and whitewashing neo-Nazis. So both sides use each other. You know, and the moment you say anything about Azov, like, you know, we should support Ukraine but not support the neo-Nazis in there, you immediately get accused of being a Kremlin puppet. So if Azov disappears tomorrow, Putin will be weeping. And if Putin disappears tomorrow, Azov will be weeping. They need each other and they use each other very effectively. Just like during the Cold War, the hawkish parties of America and Washington, they loved each other. They used each other to get more money and more power and to pursue their agendas.
Mm-hmm. So back to the photos.
Okay, so this is the insane part. The Western media, and I mean just mainstream Western and Israeli media, spent the spring of last year of 2022 saying that Azov got rid of its Nazis, because they had to explain somehow of, you know, we spent years reporting that these people are neo-Nazis and then suddenly they're not. What happened? Okay. So they said, you know, Azov got rid of the original neo-Nazis. They started as a small neo-Nazi group, but then they somehow saw the light and they got rid of them. They got rid of them. Okay. The battalion is now indistinguishable from any other groups. So at the time, the Azov Brigade, which by that point has gone to the side of brigade, if you think that if you would be doing an article saying that there are no more neo-Nazis in charge of Azov, the first thing you would do is find out who the hell is in charge of them, okay? And the person who was in charge of them at the time is this gentleman, Denis Prokopenko, okay? Here's our hero. Here's the person who's the commander of Azov. And articles mention him, okay? Here he is in the top left on the cover of the Black Sun, which is, you see that symbol above there? That is the same symbol used by the Buffalo shooter and the Chrysler. That's another very popular neo-Nazi sign. Okay. This is
the symbol used by the Buffalo shooter in New York State and the Chrysler shooter in New Zealand.
Yes, correct. And it's one of the most popular neo-Nazi symbols in the world. Okay. And there, and it also happens to be the name. This, it was also part of Azov's insignia. And it also happens to be the name of Azov's informal core magazine. Okay, so this is him interviewing for their magazine. There he is. Okay. Then Azov's original, the original Azov battalion had a subgroup in it. Okay. And the group, you know, informally called themselves the Borodach Division, the Bearded Guy Division. Okay. And their insignia is that it's a Totenkopf, which is a, again, one of the most popular neo-Nazi signs in the world. Okay, it was originally used by the Nazi Party in the group that used the part of the SS that used to guard the concentration camps used it. Today it is one of the most popular neo-Nazi signs in the world. And so this Prokopenko's group used the Borodach. This is what they use, and it's a very specific style. It's not just any skull and crossbones. I don't know if you can zoom in, but there it's a very specific style, and that is exactly what they did. All they did is they gave the skull a mustache and a beard. Okay, but overall, this is a Totenkopf. This is one of the signs used by Nazi Germany, the group that guarded the concentration camps. And this is on, and this is used by neo-Nazis today. Okay, so this is what this guy is part of. Yeah, that's from the ADL website that I just pulled up.
Anti-Defamation League. Okay.
Yep. So this is exactly, you can look down to the fissures on the skull, to the cracks of the bones. Okay, So there he is. This is our hero. Okay. This is who's in charge of Azov at the same time. Okay, at the time that they were saying there's no neo-Nazis in Azov, here's a man who was with Azov at the very beginning of the battalion's founding. Okay? So we're talking about like the most basic lapse of journalistic principles. Okay? And now moving right along, so before he was in Azov, Prokopenko was part of the White Boys Club. And this is the far-right soccer hooligans, they call them, okay? And they celebrated when he was awarded a medal in Ukraine. So this is where he came out of. This is who the guy who was commanding us over the time came out of. Okay. This is the White Boys Club celebrating him. This is their logo. Down there is it's a Nazi eagle that it shows right there. It's just adapted for with their symbol. If you scroll up a little bit, this says in their tribunals, it says 100% white. That's what that says in Ukrainian right there. And then if you go up there, there's the White Boys 88, which is
Karl Hitler.
Yep. And then and it uses the Celtic cross in there. And
so 88 stands for Heil Hitler, right? Because it's the eighth letter of the alphabet.
Yep. And it's a very common. This is their Instagram page, and they're celebrating him. And they say, you know, we are extraordinarily proud of him who represents our bleachers, you know, because the bleachers of the football, of the soccer. Okay. This is where he came out of. So you would think that, you know, and oh, and by the way, the second in command at the time, his deputy, happens to also be not only a veteran of Azov, but also part of the Patriot of Ukraine, which is the neo-Nazi group that formed Azov in the first place. Okay? So you would have these Jewish magazines, and you would have American magazines, even including quoting him and saying that the neo-Nazis have left, you know, the neo-Nazis have left Azov. So we're talking about, like, you're a reporter and you're covering, you're not even going to take 2 seconds to see who's the people who are in charge of it. I mean, as I wrote in my piece, there's a difference between like fog of war and just willful blind. And the entire Azov has been denazified story is just full of just utter, it almost gets hilarious. Like they would have the Times of London did an article saying that all the Nazis left Azov. And in it, there's a man with a shirt, an Azov soldier with a shirt of a neo-Nazi band, of like a hardcore dream of killing Jews neo-Nazi band wearing a shirt at the photograph illustrating how the neo-Nazis have left Azov.
Oh, has left Azov. I thought you said loved Azov. I'm like, no, that makes sense. Okay, they have left Azov, right.
There's a Times of London article saying Azov has changed, Azov has de-radicalized, and the headline photo has an Azov soldier with a neo-Nazi t-shirt. Okay? Like, I mean, you know, Forbes did a piece, and in the piece they said that the Azov battalion stopped using that Wolfsangel sign, the neo-Nazi sign. The Wolfsangel is literally, and I went to the Wayback Machine, which chronicles websites. The Azov battalion, it was the top sign on their website when you go there at the day that the Forbes article came out. So the day the Forbes article is claiming that they dropped the symbol, if you went to their website, their official website, it's there right at the top. It's the symbol across all of their social media accounts. It's a profile photo of all of their social media accounts. It's difficult for me to understand how, what it would take to just research and fact check such an article and publish it with such an obvious falsehood. And that's the entire, I mean, you just read the story and it's one after another. It's just ignoring and believing. It's just, all they say is, we have no neo-Nazis. Okay, sounds great. Publish it. You know, so you have one more collage of, this is astounding, of the guy who was celebrated across MSNBC and Congress. That's him. Okay, this is the Azov delegation in Congress meeting with members of Congress and Senate. And there are several others of them. And then they went on to speak at Stanford University, where Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, attended. And then if you go to the next one, this is an insane one. This was first published by Moss Robeson, who's a researcher on Twitter. He published it on Medium, and then he also tweeted this out. So if you could zoom in a little bit, okay? This is on the MSNBC on the bottom. Here is Dmytro Kozatsky. He's the press officer of the Azov Brigade. Okay? Here he is meeting with Marcy Kaptur, who is a member of Congress, a representative from Ohio. She's next to him. Okay. And there he is grinning. Okay. And if you scroll over a little bit, you'll see here he is on MSNBC being celebrated. Okay. On with Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC. Okay. At the time, this was last fall. Okay. At the time this was happening, his Twitter was a Whitman sampler of neo-Nazism, okay? So you can go...
A white man sampler, but I'm sorry, couldn't help it, yeah.
Oh, totally. It, it's It'd be funny if it wasn't so scary. So here he is with a shirt right there with a lion. That shirt is the insignia of a Waffen-SS, of a Ukrainian division for the Third Reich. They fought for Nazi Germany. They weren't particularly good at fighting, but where they excelled was war crimes, such as burning Polish villagers alive. And if you see the last several Nazis that have been kicked out of America, like a couple of them at least were involved with that group, okay, with that division. So then there is our hero with 1488. Again, 88 is for Heil Hitler. 14 is for the 14 words of white supremacy. It's also, you can look it up, but it's a very, very, very common white supremacist symbol, okay? Then there he is liking Hitler, liking a tweet that congratulates for Hitler's birthday of the great Adolf Hitler. And then also at the very bottom there with the graffiti, it says death to Kikes. And there's a graffiti with SS bolts. You can kind of see in there, but underneath it says death to Kikes. Okay.
Kikes, by the way, there's some people don't know that's a slur for Jews.
Yes. It's the N word for Jews. Okay. So, and that's the tweet he left. Okay. And this is just a tiny sample of what was there. And this is what was paraded around Congress, MSNBC, and a Manhattan Film Festival. Okay. Now, I don't know if you remember, but a while ago, Congressman Matt Gaetz, got busted with a far right, they say Holocaust denier, bringing him to the State of the Union. Okay. And Gaetz said he didn't know anything about the guy's past. And okay. So a member of Congress brought a Holocaust denier to the State of the Union, and that was deemed important enough to result in an entire letter from the Anti-Defamation League about how dangerous this is, and if you bring somebody to Congress, that is a mark of honor. That is a tremendous privilege. You're putting your seal of approval on them. So as you know, it is very dangerous when you do that to somebody who's a far right or Holocaust denier, et cetera. And, you know, so what does it say when you have these people being Congress? And somehow I didn't see any complaints from Jewish organizations about this. This did not warrant an outcry. This did not warrant anything from the Anti-Semitism Task Force in Congress. Task Force for Combating Anti-Semitism. Did not occasion alarm. So you're talking about, you know, a far right person from America versus people who are in a battle-hardened veterans of a neo-Nazi paramilitary that we're funding. Okay, you're talking about somebody whose Twitter is just filled with hatred. Okay, and he also had images of the KKK. I mean, just everything. And we open up the doors to these people. These people are our friends. So it's despicable to see, and it's despicable to see the lack of reaction from the anti-Semitism watchdogs, from the people who, you know, from members of Congress and others who say they're here to fight anti-Semitism. And then you see that this strange discrepancy, and it's a bit alarming. At least I think it's. You know, I think it's important to call out anti-Semitism wherever you see it.
And what did you think of that New York Times article, Nazi symbols on Ukraine's front lines highlight thorny issue of history?
Yeah, here's the New York Times did not one, but three articles in the span of like a week, 10 days, okay, about neo-Nazis leading an incursion into Russia and the neo-Nazi symbols being prolific. The most standout thing in that article was that a spokesman for the Anti-Defamation League talked about there was a Ukrainian soldier who got caught with a patch, and the patch had a Totenkopf, the death head symbol, okay, popular neo-Nazi symbol, and the patch itself was for a far-right band. The Southern Poverty Law Center considers it hate music. Okay, so this is a band that was it's called Death in June. It was named after the Night of the Long Knives, which is a Nazi event in which the Nazi Party purged itself. It's a band that very much is problematic, to say the least, okay? And the ADL, I want to make sure I'm quoting them.
Hold on one second. Let me
I want to make sure you show exactly what they said.
You're talking about they're in the Nazis' thorny issue article, right? Okay, here we go. So the patch in the photograph sets the Totenkopf atop a Ukrainian flag with the small number 6 below. That patch is the official merchandise of Death in June, a British neo-folk band that the Southern Poverty Law Center has said produces hate speech that exploits themes and images of fascism and Nazism. The Anti-Defamation League considers the Totenkopf common hate symbol, but Jake Hyman, a spokesman for the group, said it was impossible to, quote, make an inference about the wearer or the Ukrainian army, end quote, based on the patch. Quote, the image, while offensive, is that of a musical band, end quote, Mr. Hyman said.
Here's the even better. The band now uses the photograph posted by the Ukrainian military to market the Totenkopf patch. So this is when you see how this is real. This feeds anti-Semitism. This feeds hatred. Okay, when we okay this, they then take it and run with it. And the ADL has a long history of going after Spotify, for example. They have attacked Spotify for being lax in spreading hate music and allowing hate music to proliferate. They have also gone after Amazon and others for, allowing Nazi merchandise and neo-Nazi merchandise, for having very easy rules, you can get pretty much anything. And I'm not just talking about like historical things, like an actual history. You can just get neo-Nazi patches, neo-Nazi clothing, whatever you want. Okay. And the ADL has been at the forefront of just of making sure people know about this. They have a database and everything. So it's just, I don't understand how you could say that, you know, it's just, you know, it, we can't make,
we can't any make inference. An inference about it. I know, that's so embarrassing.
Make an inference from somebody who holds a, who has a neo-Nazi symbol in your database, and the neo-Nazi symbol is of a neo-Nazi band, of a hate group band. You could say they're technically not neo-Nazis. They're considered hate music. Okay. And all of a sudden, you know, we've made inferences because the ADL has been forward about calling out Spotify and calling out Amazon and calling out all these other people that do hate music. But suddenly for this, it's very strange to suddenly be so, I would say, open-minded, strangely open-minded about this. And it's just, you also see like the New York Times did 3 articles, okay? Here we go. For Ukrainian military, far-right Russian volunteers make for worrisome allies. Article 2. Here we go. Anti-Kremlin group involved in border raid is led by a neo-Nazi. And Article 3, Nazi symbols on Ukraine's front lines highlight thorny issues in history. The paper of record does 3 articles, okay, in the space of 10 days or so. About the army that we are arming and giving billions to, including top-notch lethal weapons, okay? You would think that, in general, the Jewish community would be up in arms about it. You would think that, I mean, this is the same people who, anytime Marjorie Taylor Greene sneezes, it's the second coming of Hitler. So you would think these people who can't sleep at night, or Corbyn, or others, okay?
Roger Waters.
Roger Waters. Okay, Roger Waters is a direct threat.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.